I'm a member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon and Alateen, and my name is Angie Baldwin. I'm very glad to be here today. I want to thank Don and others that were responsible for inviting me to come. Chip and I have already had a grand time. We spent the morning at the Booth Museum while many of you were playing golf, and we just had a wonderful time. What a beautiful city you have here. My home group is a one-purpose Al-Anon family group. We meet in Santa Rosa Beach, Florida. As was mentioned earlier, Chip and I do live in Destin, and we bring you greetings from the home of the sugar white sand and the emerald green water. Chip says, you know, we get to live where people dream of living, and that is certainly true. It is, and it's just as much fun as you would dream that it would be. We really do love it there. Even during tourist season, we love it there. I told Chip, I said, I don't know what it is, but I can be in a traffic jam for 15 or 20 minutes, and I just sit there, and I'm just singing, and I'm just happy. It doesn't bother me a bit. But the tourists that are there, the traffic bothers tremendously. But us locals, we're fine. I'm asked to tell you a little bit about what my life was like and what happened and what my life is like now. I always like to start by saying a big thank you to Alcoholics Anonymous. Most of the people that I love the most in my life are alive today because of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's no way that I could ever repay and I could ever do enough to say thank you to what you've done to help those people that I love. So I say thank you from the bottom of my heart for this program. I also say thank you as a member of Al-Anon. Thank you for being willing to allow us to use your 12 steps so that we too could experience that spiritual awakening, so that we too could have a new way of life. Thank you. Thank you for the combined histories that we have together. Thank you for the foundation that you have that you continue to honor in your programs and the way you practice the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because without that program, we wouldn't be here as Al-Anons. So thank you. I was raised in a military family. My dad was a military officer. And, of course, that meant that I was always either the new kid on the block or the kid that was getting ready to leave the block. I learned not to make friends because if I made a friend, I was going to have to say goodbye to that friend, and I knew I probably would never see him again. So I always grew up feeling like I was different, feeling like something was different about me and something was different about my family. My mother was a raging alcoholic, and she, like many in her generation then, got us off to school, got my dad off to work, and then she started drinking, and she would drink most of the day, and then when we came home, she wouldn't drink, and then my dad would get home, and they would have a few drinks before dinner, and that's the way life went for a long time in my family. I have a brother that's 6 years older than me, and my brother was a star athlete. I continue to be amazed by him more as I get older, because the way I dealt with being the new kid was I lived in a world of books. I read constantly. I was telling Chip I substitute teach a little bit, and there's a girl in the class I teach at lunchtime, and she's the only girl in class. She goes to lunch with a book, and I said, you know, that was me. I went to lunch with a book. You know, I didn't talk much. I read. And so that little girl was me. That's how I existed in my family. My brother was an athlete. He was a star athlete everywhere we ever went. He was the pitcher on the baseball team, the quarterback on the football team, the head of the golf team, the forward on the basketball team. And I thought, how did he do that? Because he was always the new kid. And then I thought, boy, there were some old kids that weren't happy he showed up. But, you know, they loved him. Everybody loved him. He was the star winner of the science and math teams in Mississippi when we lived there. He did great. So he was always gone. So growing up in that family, I knew something was wrong. I don't even remember seeing my mother mix a drink until I was an adult. But I knew there was something wrong in our family. There was things happening there that didn't need to be happening there. And so I figured it had to be me. So I thought, you know, if I can be smart enough, cute enough, intelligent enough, wise enough, funny enough, if I can just be enough, everything's going to be okay in my family. But, you know, I could never figure out what enough was. So I grew up in that family trying to figure out enough and a lot of other things as well. I lived most of my life based on fear. I made all the decisions I made based on fear. I don't remember a day growing up that I wasn't afraid of something. I was afraid of living. I was afraid of dying. I was afraid of being a success. I was afraid of being a failure. I was afraid of getting married one day. I was afraid I'd never get married. I was afraid of having children. I was afraid I wouldn't have children. I was afraid of everything. I learned how to lie. I learned how to manipulate. manipulate. I thought I could control the universe and everything in it and did my best to try. I could talk you into a corner and make you wish that you could get out of it just by the words that would come out of my mouth. I wasn't a very happy person because I was such a scared person. As I grew up in that family, of course, there came a time when the opposite sex became quite appealing to me. And this is what he was like for me. He was tall. He's good looking. He'd walk in a room and people would say, "Hey, he's here, he's here." You know, everybody'd be happy to see him. He could tell a story. Oh, my goodness, he could tell a story. He would have you on the edge of your seat for that story. He liked to do kind of risky things, maybe drove race cars or maybe skydived or drove motorcycles, something like that. You know, he had always kind of living on the edge. He didn't know how to handle anger. He didn't know anything about any other emotion besides anger. He had been either physically or emotionally or sexually abused growing up, or all three. And he was quite wounded. And you know, it took years before I realized one day, he was me. He was me. You know, I could be in a room of 500 people, and the spotlight could shine on one person that just happened to be the only alcoholic in the room. That's what would happen for me. The heavens would open up, the sunbeams would shine down on that one alcoholic. And man, the stars would be in my eyes. And I have to say, the sunbeams must have shone down on me too, because he would kind of seek me out. You know, we were just kind of drawn to each other. And that's who I was attracted to in those days. And you know, my wounded heart would call out to his wounded heart. And we would join hands together and we would walk off into the sunset to live happily ever after. And for me, it just never worked. It just never worked. 1 year of my life went like this. I graduated high school on June the 4th at the age of 16. I got married on June the 7th. I turned 17 on June the 15th. I became pregnant in August, got separated in December, got divorced in February, and our daughter Amanda was born in May, and I turned 18 in June. That was 1 year of my life. I had many years like that. Many years like that. In 1978, I was living in a little town called Andalusia, Alabama. I was in a musical at the junior college, and I played the lady of the evening. And the sunbeams and starbeams shone down on the man that played the villain. And his name was Paul Pace. He invited me out. We went and saw Superman. They'll tell you how long ago it was. Superman with Christopher Reeves. And on the way home that night, this is what I heard him say. He said, "Angie, I'm going to an AA meeting Saturday night. Would you like to go with me?" Now, we talked about this years later, and what he really said was, "Angie, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm going to an AA meeting Saturday night. Would you like to go with me?" As far as I know, that's the first time in my life that I consciously know about what's called denial. You know, denial is when I hear something or I see something that I just refuse to hear or refuse to hear. And I could tell you today that he did not say, "I'm an alcoholic." But I know he did, because he told me he did. The week rocks on, my mom says, "What are you doing this weekend?" I said, "Well, I'm going to go to an AA meeting." She said, "What is that?" I said, "You know, I don't know, but at that time I raced race cars." And so I said, "AAA is for car insurance and stuff, so I'm thinking AA must be about cars." So she said, "Really?" And I said, "Yeah." She said, "Well, that sounds kind of interesting." I said, "Yeah, I guess so. Will you babysit Amanda?" She said she would. Paul came and picked me up, and we take off to go to this AA meeting. We go to a little town outside Andalusia called Little Bitty Town called Red Level, Alabama. And we pull up from this old brick building, and across the front of it, it says First Step. And so Paul says, "I'm going to go inside for a few minutes." He said, "You go over there and get on that bus, and then we're going to go to the AA meeting." I said, "Okay." So I go get on this rickety bus, and I'm sitting there thinking, wonder what this has to do with cars, you know, this rickety bus. I'm sitting there, and these men start coming out, 10 men, 12 men, 14 men, 16 men. They're all getting on this bus. I started thinking, "Angie, you have done it again, honey. You're going off with a man you don't know very well. You don't know where you're going. You don't know what's going to happen when you get there, and you sure don't know who all these other men are and what part they're going to play. And here you sit." Paul came out, cranked up that bus. Now, I learned later that he was a counselor at that First Step and that it was an alcohol and drug treatment center, but I didn't know that then. He cranks up that old bus, and we take off, and we drive for about 15 or 20 minutes, and we go to a little town called Op, Alabama, and we pull up in a church parking lot. I have never been so happy to get to church in my life as I was that night. We all troop off that bus, and we walk in, and he said, we're all going over here, and you're going to go over here. And when I turned to my left, I saw a lady that I can see as clearly today as I saw her that evening. Her name was Miss Ida, and she was standing in the door. And this was 1978, so she had this big beehive hairdo, dark brown hair. She had her glasses on a chain around her neck. She was wearing one of her best Sunday dresses. It was royal blue. She had on black patent leather heels. She was a lady. And she held out her hand to me, and she said, "Honey, you just come on with me." And I said, "Okay," and I went inside. And that was my first Al-Anon meeting. I can't tell you one word that was said that night, but I can tell you that I felt like I had come home. I'm not going to look at my hands here because it'll make me cry, but I could still see her patting me on my hand. She patted my hand that whole hour, and I just sat there and cried. And she'd say, "Honey, it's going to be okay." She gave me my One Day at a Time book that I still carry with me today. On the way home that night, Paul said, "How did you like the meeting?" I said, "Oh, I loved it." I said, "I absolutely loved it, but I can't go back again." He said, "Why not?" And I said, "Because I don't know any alcoholics." Well, you see, my favorite Aunt Mutt was alcoholic. My favorite Uncle Vernon was alcoholic. My favorite Uncle Cecil was an alcoholic. My mother was an alcoholic. And by this time, I'd been married to several alcoholics. But see, to me, it was Aunt Mutt. It was Uncle Vernon. It was Uncle Cecil. It was my mother. It was my husband. I never associated who they were and what they did with the disease of alcoholism. Paul said, "Well, Angie, you know me." And I said, "Yeah, I do. But I will tell you, in 1978 in Al-Anon in South Alabama, it was all women that were married to alcoholics that went to AA. That's who was in that room." And I said, "Yeah, I know you." But I said, "But I'm different than those other people in that room." So I was in and out. I'd go to Al-Anon a while, then I wouldn't go. Then I'd go a while, then I wouldn't go. We had three pieces of literature that I can remember then. One was called Al-Anon Family Groups. It was kind of a how-to book on how to do Al-Anon. And then one was called The Dilemma of the Alcoholic Marriage, and the other one was called One Day at a Time. And those were the three books that we had. So I would go, I'd stop. I'd go, I'd stop. Thank goodness, June 15th, 1990, I came back to Al-Anon and have not stopped since that time and don't plan to. I accepted the fact that I'm never going to graduate, and I've been a continuous and very happy member of Al-Anon since that time. As I shared with you, I did have a daughter that was born to that first marriage, and one morning, May 18th, 1991, I woke up, and I called my two best friends, and I said, "Let's go find out what's going on with Amanda." My daughter was at the University of Alabama, and I hadn't heard from her in 3 months, and that was very unusual that I had not heard from her in that length of time. We were pretty close and kept in pretty close contact with each other. I'd been back in Al-Anon for about a year by this time, and I just was trying to live the life that I thought my higher power wanted me to live, so I was just waiting on God to let me know when it was time for me to go to Tuscaloosa. And I woke up that morning and knew it was time. I will tell you that there have been some times in my life, if I'm really working this program the way I believe I'm meant to work it, if I'm staying spiritually fit, if I'm living these steps, if I'm working these steps, if I'm working with my sponsor, if I'm sponsoring women, if I'm working with others, if I'm being of service to God and those I love and those I care about, sometimes God will just work in my life in such a way that I'll be sitting there saying, "What is going on here? What is happening here?" And that day was that kind of day for me. We got to Tuscaloosa. We got to the apartment complex where my daughter lived. We got out of the car, and the first thing we saw was a bank of mailboxes, and there was letters all over the ground underneath the mailboxes. We walked over there. I picked up one of them. It had my daughter's name on it. We started picking up others. They all had my daughter's name on it. It was mail just laying all over the ground. We picked it all up. We put it in a garbage bag, put it in the car. Went to the apartment door. Nobody answered. I said, "I'm going to go find the apartment manager and get him to open the apartment. We're going to see Amanda today." I walked off. One friend stayed there just in case Amanda came home. And as my other friend and I were walking down the stairs, Melody called out and she said, "Angie, she's here. Amanda's here." I turned back around and I walked back in. Amanda was standing in the doorway and I hugged her. And I said, "Amanda, it's going to be okay. Everything's going to be okay." We walked inside and sat down and God took over. I said to my daughter, I said, "Amanda, I know something's wrong. I don't know what it is, but I know it's something. And I want you to know that I'm here today to make you an offer." And I remember thinking at that point, I thought, "Well, I wonder what this offer is going to be." And I said, "I'm willing to do whatever I have to do, go wherever I have to go, pay whatever I've got to pay to get you whatever help you need. But the offer is only for today. And it's only for an hour. If you say no, you don't want the offer, that's okay. We'll go to lunch. We'll have a great time. We'll enjoy each other. I'm still going to be your mother. I'm always going to love you. I'm still going to see you. But I'll never make this offer to you again. And I thought to myself, well, why not? And I stood up. My friend stood up. Amanda stood up. You know, and I said, I'm leaving. And they said, where are you going? I said, I'm going to go give her an hour to make up her mind. So one friend went with me and one friend stayed with Amanda. If you're ever in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, at University Mall, think about me, because for an hour I walked up and down that mall just sobbing because I knew my daughter was not going to accept that offer. My friend, on the other hand, was saying, what are you going to do if she does? I said, it's not going to matter because she's not going to accept the offer. We went back to the apartment, went in, sat down, talked just a little bit, and Amanda said, Mama, I accept your offer. You know, I went over to the telephone, and I picked up the phone, and I knew one therapist in Fairhope, Alabama, and I dialed that number, and it was a Saturday, and she answered the phone, and I said, I'm here in Tuscaloosa with my daughter, and she's told me, by now Amanda had said, Mama, I have written a few bad checks. I said, she's told me she's written a few bad checks. So the lady said, well, you know, maybe she's got a mental illness. And I said, maybe she does. I knew a little bit about that. And I thought, you know, maybe we can get her some good medicine or get her some good therapy. She'll be okay. So my friend said, let me make some calls. So we hung up. She called me back. She said, Angie, you need to have her at Providence Hospital in Mobile, Alabama at 9 o'clock in the morning. And I said, we'll be there. And I hung up. By this time, it's probably about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and we're in Tuscaloosa, way up here in North Alabama. And I said, we're going to go rent a U-Haul it. And Amanda said, what do we need a U-Haul it for? And I said, we're going to pack you up. We're going to pack you up, and we're leaving Tuscaloosa. And all this time I'm thinking, why are we packing her up? Why are we leaving Tuscaloosa? But you know, we went and got the last U-Haul it they had, and we came back, and we packed her up. And one of my friends said, Angie, you don't have to worry about drugs and alcohol. And I said, what are you talking about? That had never entered my mind. She said, there's no drugs here. She said, the only thing in this apartment is raw cookie dough and Kool-Aid. I said, okay. So we pack her up. We go to Andalusia, Alabama, and we sleep about 2 hours there at my friend's house, and we leave the trailer there, and we go on to Providence Hospital, and we're there at 9 o'clock that morning. And I meet her psychiatrist, Dr. Thomas, who's gone on to that great meeting in the sky. He shook my hand, and he asked me, he said, what do you think might be the problem? I said, well, she tells me she's written a few bad checks. And he said, well, maybe she's got a mental illness. And I said, maybe she does, and we can get her some help. Everything's going to be okay. She stayed in that hospital for 2 months. And every week I would go see her on the weekend. And every weekend there would be some dramatic revelation that she would tell me. Every weekend. One weekend I went and she hated me for everything I'd ever done, from thinking about her, conceiving her, birthing her, raising her. She hated me, hated me, hated me. That was a very short meeting. I didn't stay long that day. Every weekend it would be something dramatic. And some of them were pretty powerful, serious things. The worst weekend for me was the day that Amanda told me she was alcoholic. That was the worst. And I do want you to know that anybody that I talk about in my story that's still alive have given me permission to talk about them as I need to share my story. That was the worst day for me. You see, I had been running to and from the disease of alcoholism all my life. And I knew I had a decision to make that day. Was I going to run to Amanda, or was I going to run from Amanda? It's about a 4-hour drive from where she was in the hospital to where I was living in Dothan. And on the way home that day, I buried her. I planned her funeral. I planned who would speak, what we would say, how she'd be dressed, how we'd do her hair. I planned the headstone, the whole thing. It took me the whole drive home to do her funeral. And you know, it was several years later before I realized that I really did bury her that day. I don't know about you, but when Amanda was born and I looked down at this little bundle of pink, boy, did I have plans for her. Did I have plans for her. She was going to be the first female president of the United States. She was going to be the first female senator of the United States. She was going to be the first astronaut to walk on the moon. She didn't have a chance. I had big plans for her. And see, that's what I had to bury that day. I had to bury that fantasy child that I had always carried around in my mind before I could ever see this precious gift of God. This precious gift of God that he had loaned to me. And once I got home that day, I got on my knees, and I truly took step one in a way I had never taken it before. And I worked all of the steps in ways that I had never worked them before. I would love to talk for a couple of days on the steps, but Don R. Taper has told me I cannot do that. So I will just say this about the steps. You know, when I go to the Pizza Hut, I love to get the Supreme Pizza. I love the one that's got everything on it. And I say to the waitress, I want to order a supreme personal pan pizza. When she walks away, I don't say to her, but only bring me the crust. See, to me, that's what it means if I'm in any program of recovery and I don't work those steps. And I mean work them. I mean work them and live them and breathe them. Why would I want to be in a program that the only way I can have a spiritual awakening is to work the steps? It doesn't matter how many people I sponsor or how many people I see or how many meetings I go to or how cute I am. I'm not going to have a spiritual awakening and have the kind of relationship I want with the God of my understanding if I don't work those steps. To me, that's like ordering the supreme pizza and only asking for the crust. See, I don't just want the crust. I want everything on that supreme pizza. I want so much of it that when I finish, I'm going to lick my finger and dab it on those crumbs and even eat the crumbs. That's what I want from recovery. And that's what I'm promised if I work those steps. Okay? So that's what I set about to do. Amanda got out of treatment after 60 days. She was in that hospital. It was one of those God things. She was at a hospital that just happened to have a drug and alcohol unit on one side and a mental health unit on the other. So she started off on the mental health unit, and then they just shifted her over to the drug and alcohol unit. When she got out, she came and stayed with me for a while, and so she was living with me, and we proceeded to try to learn how to be a mother and a daughter in recovery. And it was a tough first year. I'm the kind of person, or had been the kind of person, that would know everything there was to know about you in a couple of hours, and you wouldn't know one thing about me. I would know all kind of stuff. We would be great friends. You'd think I was your best friend in the world. But you know, if somebody said, tell me what you really know about Angie, you might know three or four things. I, on the other hand, could tell a couple of hundred about you. And see, I had to change all that. I had to change all that, and I had to become real. I remember conversations we would have, and I'd be sitting there, and Amanda would be sitting there, and we'd both just be crying, just trying to have a conversation with each other that was real and honest and from the heart. It was hard. Amanda had been living with me a couple of months, and I came home one day, and she said she had to pay me $100 a month rent to stay with me. She said, Mama, you know, I'm working all these part-time jobs. I'm going everywhere. I'm doing all this stuff, and I just don't think I'm going to have the rent money tomorrow. Well, see, we'd had an agreement made with us before she came to live with me. And that agreement said a lot of things. And one of the things it said was she had to pay me that $100 a month rent. So I said, Amanda, it's okay if you don't have the money tomorrow. I said, but just know when I get home, you need to have all your stuff packed. Because, you see, I talked to the Salvation Army before you came to stay with me, and they told me they'd give you two hots and a cot if I would just drop you off. So I'm going to drop you off there tomorrow, and you'll get two hots and a cot. I'm still going to love you. I'm still going to be your mother. I'm still going to care about you. I'm still going to see you. But you'll never be able to live with me again because you will have violated our contract. And I said, anything you want, you better take because whatever you leave here is going to be mine. Well, her eyes were big as dinner plates, you know. And I turned around and just kind of sauntered into the bathroom and I got in the shower. And I mean, I let loose. I just was crying and sobbing because I knew I could do that. I knew I could do that. I knew I could take her to the Salvation Army and I knew I could drop her off. You see, there were times in my daughter's life that I treated her less of a way than I would treat any of you in this room. I would say things to her that I would never say to the bank teller at the bank. I would say things to her in a tone of voice that I would never use to the checkout clerk at the grocery store. But I would do that to my own daughter. I knew I had finally gotten to a place in my recovery where I had just as much respect and dignity as I did for Amanda, as I did for anybody else on this earth. And I knew if I had a contract with anybody else on this earth and they broke it, there would be consequences to pay for that. And I knew that I saw Amanda as just as much a person of worth as I did anybody else. And there'd be consequences for her too. I got home the next day and the rent money was on the table and it was there every month until she moved out. There were some great lessons I learned. I'm just going to share a couple of them. One of the lessons I learned was to say what I meant and mean what I say. You see, I had lied to Amanda so much. I used to talk about how she lied to me. I lied to her all the time. I would say, Amanda, if you do that again, blah, blah, blah. If you say that again, blah, blah, blah. If you do that again, blah, blah, blah. But see, I never did blah, blah, blah. I lied to her over and over and over and over. And I had to stop that. I had to stop that. If I wasn't going to do blah, 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 I must not say blah, blah, blah. I also learned that year that if my name wasn't in the sentence, it was none of my business. You taught me that in Al-Anon. If my name wasn't in the sentence, it was none of my business. Is Amanda going to meetings? I would say to my sponsor, I wonder if Amanda's going to her meeting. She would say, Angie, that's none of your business. So then I would say, well, is Amanda, Angie's daughter, going to meetings? She'd say, no, you cannot do that. Is Amanda working with her sponsors? Amanda working the steps? I couldn't ask any of those questions. None of them. I can't today. I don't know today, you know. I kind of know because sometimes she tells me, but I don't ever ask, you know. And I learned in this program that what was my business was, is Angie going to meetings? Is Angie working with her sponsor? Is Angie working the steps? Is Angie being of service to others? That's what was my business. And I will tell you, once I dove into this program, that took up all of my time. Just trying to work on me and my relationship with God and my fellow man took up all my time. I didn't have time worrying about what Amanda was doing. There were great lessons to learn there. I will tell you that Amanda celebrated 25 years this year thanks to her good work in Alcoholics Anonymous and all the people that have helped her along the way in Alcoholics Anonymous. We have a great relationship. We're still mother and daughter. I think there's an inherent tension there sometimes just when you say those words, mother-daughter. She's still alcoholic and I'm still on sick Al-Anon, okay? But we're both in recovery and we're both trying. And when we do have issues and we do have problems, we try to work through them and we love each other. She has two beautiful children that are the light of my life, and we love each other. The day that my grandson looked up at me and said, Grammy, you are awesome. I mean, it was like the fireworks went off. You know, the fireworks went off. I love him. One day, late one night in 1991, my phone rang, and I answered the phone, and the person on the other end of the phone said, do you blame me because Amanda's alcoholic? I said, what? And the voice said, do you blame me because Amanda's alcoholic? And I realized that it was Amanda's dad. His nickname is Slim. We had not seen him in many years, but I knew that's who it was on the other end of the phone. And so we talked a little bit, and I said, no, Slim, I don't blame you. I said, you didn't cause her alcoholism. You can't cure her alcoholism, and you can't control her alcoholism. And he said, what? I said, you didn't cause her alcoholism. You can't cure her alcoholism, and you can't control her alcoholism. He said, okay, and he hung up the phone. A few weeks later, early on a Saturday morning, the phone rang. I picked up the phone, and the voice said, I'm coming to Dothan. And I said, okay, and he hung up. I called my sponsor, and I said, oh, my God. I said, Debbie, Slim is coming to Dothan to get sober. She said, how do you know? I said, he just called me on the phone. She said, what did he say? I said, he said, I'm coming to Dothan. She said, well, what else did he say? I said, nothing. I said, okay. She said, well, then what did he say? I said, he hung up. She said, how do you know I'm coming to Dothan means I'm coming to Dothan to get sober and live a new way of life? I said, because he knows that Amanda and I are in recovery, and he knows we have recovery homes. He's not coming here for any other reason than to get sober. She said, oh, gosh. She said, what are we going to do? I said, I don't know. So here you've got these two Al-Anons trying to figure out how you sober up a drunk. It was hilarious. Debbie said, I think you're supposed to use honey. And I said, well, I don't know if you put lemon in that or if it's just plain honey. And I said, I think it's something about alcohol. At some point during the day, my precious daughter in recovery walks in with a six-pack of beer. She says, Mama, I think you're supposed to use beer. So she leaves. Finally, my daughter's sponsor called Gloria. She said, Angie, don't you know any doctors? And I said, well, yeah. She said, well, call one of them. God's always so good to me with telephone calls. So I look in the phone book, and I see a doctor that I know, and I call that number. It's on a Saturday, and he answers the phone. And I told him what was going on. He said, okay, Angie. He said, tell me what drugstore you use. I did. He said, I'm going to call you in some medicine. He said, now, it's going to say to give it to him a certain way on the bottle, but you don't pay any attention to that. He said, you give it to him like candy for about 3 days, and he'll be okay. I said, okay. Well, about 8 o'clock that night, the phone rings, and it's Slim. He says, I've gotten to Clinton, Alabama, and I cannot come any further. I said, that's okay. I'll come pick you up. Clinton was about 3 hours from where I lived. He was coming from Tennessee, the hills of Tennessee. I went to Clinton, Alabama, and on that drive, I will tell you, by now, I am in Al-Anon. I'm a good Al-Anon member. I believe in this program. I'm so good at Al-Anon, and, you know, I had gone from being so fearful of the third step prayer, so fearful that God was just going to strike me down when I would say it, that now when I was saying the third step prayer, I was singing it. I was telling God, what mission have you got for me today, God, you know? Well, I will tell you, on that drive to Clanton, Alabama that night, we talked about this present mission that he had me on. Because, you see, the last time I had seen that man, it was a very violent situation, and he was very violently abusive to me. And that's the last time he'd been in my home. So God and I talked on that trip. I pulled up to Clanton to the gas station, the BP service station in Clanton, Alabama, and there he stood. He was clean cut, nice looking when I was married to him. But you see, after we got divorced, he joined a very, very well-known motorcycle gang, and so his hair's down to his waist now, and he's got a beard down here, and he's wearing leathers and chains and all that stuff, and he's tattooed from head to toe, and he gets in my car and slings a duffel bag in the back seat, and he says, okay, let's go. And I look over there, and his leathers are wet, and I realize that it's blood. He's been throwing up blood. He was as white as a sheet. I didn't know if he was going to live till we got back to Dothan, Alabama. I really didn't. We got to Dothan, and I pulled up in a grocery store parking lot, and I thought, okay, what do you get somebody that's fixing to sober up here? So I went inside, and I bought all they had. I bought 10 gallons of orange Gatorade. Slim says today when he goes to the grocery store, he can't even look down that aisle. He has to turn his head. He can't even look. And we went home. And for 3 days, I learned about the deprivation and degradation of alcoholism. You know, I tell this story because this is what it means to me as an Al-Anon. I'm in Al-Anon now, and I'm good. And I say that alcoholism is a disease. But I'll tell you, sometimes at night when I'd be home by myself, or if I'd be driving somewhere, you know, I'd think, I'm not sure it's a disease. I'm just not sure. You know, I know people that say they just quit drinking. They didn't have a program. They didn't have to do anything. I'm just not sure it's a disease. I'm so grateful to the blessed God of my understanding that he gave me that time with Slim. Because after that 3 days, there was no doubt in my mind that alcoholism is a disease. You know, the whole apartment was permeated with the smell of alcohol for over a week. We kept the windows open. We kept the doors open. I was changing sheets every 3 or 4 hours that smelled like alcohol and urine and everything else you can think of. And he couldn't sleep, so I didn't sleep. And I learned about the disease of alcoholism as he would talk in those 3 days. I know today, anytime, anywhere, any alcoholic on earth says to another person, I love you, and I'll never drink again. I know they mean that with every fiber of their being. But you see, I also know what a cunning, baffling, and powerful disease this is. I'm happy to say that this year, Slim is 21 years sober. Thanks to the goodness of people just like you, in rooms just like this, and the hard, hard work he has done on his program. He lives in Tampa, Florida, and he's got a wonderful wife, and he's got a houseboat that he always dreamed about having, and my two grandkids with Amanda, they call him Pappy Slim, and it's wonderful. It is wonderful what this program will do if we'll work this program. My mother never did get in recovery. The last few years of her life, she was sick, and so she could not go buy the alcohol. She had COPD and emphysema, didn't drive anymore. So she didn't drink, but she never got recovery. She would ask a question every once in a great while, but that was all that was ever said about that, and we didn't push it on her. The last 2 years of her life, she couldn't live by herself, so she would stay at my house 2 weeks, and then she would stay with my daughter for 2 weeks, and we kind of just shuffled her back and forth, and she was gracious to put up with that. But I will say this, I never could have done that if it had not been for the program of recovery. I never could have done that. You know, when I lived with my mother, I lived in fear every day. There's no way I ever could have invited her to live with me in my home if it wasn't for the program of recovery. One day, a few months before my mother died, she was sitting on the couch, and I was doing something in the kitchen, and she says, I know you talk about me when you speak. And at that time, I did not. I was still working on stuff, so I didn't. And I said, no, ma'am, I don't. And she said, I know you talk about me when you give those talks. And I said, no, ma'am, I really don't. And then she said, I know you talk about when I beat you. Well, you know, we had never talked about that, ever. And when she said those words, the breath just went out of me. I could not breathe. I couldn't breathe. And finally, I kind of got myself together, and I said, no, ma'am, I don't. And then she said, "Well, you know, I didn't beat you every day." And I thought, oh no, we are here. We are here. So I turned around and I said, "No, ma'am, you didn't beat me every day." I said, "But Mama, you beat me many days. And one day was one too many." And then I looked at her. I heard a speaker one time say that she was so happy that one day God had allowed her to see her mother the way she thought God saw her mother. And I'm so grateful that that's what happened to me then. I saw my mother not as the raging alcoholic of my childhood and a lot of my life, but as the way that I thought God saw her. This stoic woman. You know who I saw? I saw the woman that I think I would have been without Al-Anon. This stoic woman, so cut off from her feelings that I'd seen her cry, maybe shed two tears in her life. Never, ever. Stoic, hard woman. Hard working, hard woman who wouldn't let a feeling come within 100 yards of her. Wouldn't dare. And I walked over to her and I knelt down beside her. And I said, "Mama, I forgave you for that." I said, "I forgave you for that a long time ago." I said, "Do you remember that day I came and talked to you about things I had done to you and told you how sorry I was and asked you what I could do to make it better?" She said, "Yeah." I said, "Well," I said, "I had forgiven you even before then." I said, "I forgave you for every lick, every drop of blood, everything. I have forgiven you for that." And I said, "I love you." And she hugged me and started crying. And we just cried together. And a couple months later, she died. I tell this because it is so important to me. I don't think our literature in either program talks enough about forgiveness and the power of forgiveness. I thought I was free before that day. And I was in some ways. But I will tell you that that conversation with my mother gave me a new freedom that I had not had before. And I believe it gave her a freedom that she hadn't had before either. So I work with sponsees on forgiveness. And we have forgiven people all kind of places, from churchyards to bars to all kind of places. We have forgiven people. Forgiveness is such a powerful thing. And it's powerful to me in my recovery today. It's powerful. And it does powerful things in the lives of people that we love and people that we care about, I believe. My brother's had his own issues as he's grown up in recovery and as he's grown up doing the deal that we all grow up to do. I won't talk about his issues, but I will say this. We were sitting at my mother's one day and we were all sitting around talking and we were talking about books that we had read. My brother has four daughters and my daughter Amanda was there and we were talking about we're all big readers. And my brother piped up and he said, "Well, you know, I've never read a book." Now, my brother is 6 years older than I, so at this time he was probably about 58. And I said, "You've never read a book?" And he said, "No." And I mean, I was just in shock. And I said, "Well, why not?" He said, "Well, the letters just get all jumbled up." And I just was blown away. And I looked over there, my mother was, we were all just blown away. And I said, "Well, Glenn, are you dyslexic?" He said, "I don't know what that is, but the letters just get all jumbled up." And his wife said, "Yes, my brother, a college graduate, was in hospital administration all of his career." And his wife said, "Yes, sometimes he brings home reports from the hospital for me to read to him because he can't read them because the letters are all jumbled up." Oh, my gosh, you know. It explained in that one conversation 1,000 things that I understood about my brother and I. 1,000 things. You see, I had wanted for years and years and years my brother to be closer, and we just weren't. 6-year age difference, it's going to be hard, but I was trying. I knew he liked sports, so I tried to learn about sports. I knew he liked golf, so I'd learn about anything I knew that was part of his world, and I'd try that, and it just didn't work. At that time at my Al-Anon meeting, we had a tin can that we called the God Can. I can't, God can. And so we said, you know, when you're finally ready to give something to God, write it down on a piece of paper and put it in the can. And we would pass it around every meeting. Well, finally one night, I wrote my brother's name down on the piece of paper and I put it in that can. I called Debbie, my sponsor, the next day. I said, "Well," I said, "I guess you saw me putting something in the can last night." She said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, it was Glenn's name. My brother's name is Glenn." She said, "Oh, I am so thankful for that." And I said, "Why?" She said, "Because now God's going to be able to work." Well, this is probably a year later. We're having this conversation at my mother's dinner table. So I said, "Well, Glenn, have you ever listened to a book on tape?" He said, no, I hadn't. I said, me either. I said, I try, but I said, I can't. I said, I start thinking about what I'm going to cook for supper, what I'm going to wear to work tomorrow. My mind goes 50 places. I can't do books on tape. I've got to have the book and see the words. I said, if I got a book on tape for you, would you read it? Would you listen to it? He thought a few minutes. He said, yeah. I said, okay. So that Monday, I went to the books. I went to the Walden bookstore, and I walked in, and I thought, what did you get for a man 58 years old for the first book he's ever going to hear? So I got him a James Patterson mystery, and I mailed it off. And about a week later, he called me, and he calls it reading. He was crying on the phone. He said, Angie, I have just read my first book, and it was wonderful. When can you send me another one? He just about broke me that first year. You know, those books are kind of expensive. His wife says, I have created a monster. He has books on tape all over his house. One day he called me. He was so proud. He said, guess what I did today? I said, what? He said, I bought my own book. I said, thank God. His daughter had come to visit, and he asked her, would she go with him? And she did. Okay. Then one day he called me, he read a book that I hadn't even read the book yet. I said, there's something wrong with this picture. You have read my favorite author before I have. Okay. I say this to say this. My brother's never been in a room that I know of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's never been to an Al-Anon meeting. But people, you have changed his life. How many people's lives do we change that we never even know? I'm telling you, you changed his life. And you see, for years and years, I had been trying to figure out a way to get in his world. And when I gave it to God, God brought him right into my world. Right into my world of books. And we have a connection that like we've never had before. Because of God, Al-Anon, AA, and these programs of recovery. I was a good Al-Anon member except in one area of my life, and that was the area of male-female relationships. I just didn't think God could do it as well as me. Now, with my track record and the wreckage behind me, I don't know what that says my view of God was about that area, but I just didn't think he could do it as good as me. No, seriously, I had a lot of fear about that, a lot of fear, and I was just scared to give that to God. But finally, about 10 years ago, one day I said, God, I am done. I am done. I am broken. I'm done. For whatever reason, my picker has been broke. It is broke. It will be broke. I'm giving it back to you. I'm not going to look anymore. I'm not going to go on any of these websites. People been wanting me to go on eHarmonies and all that stuff. I'm not going to do any of that. I'm not going to go anywhere looking for a man. I'm done. I'm going to concentrate on being a happy, joyous, and free woman in recovery. That's what I'm going to do. And then I said, but just in case there's somebody, you have somebody out there for me one day, I'm also going to, instead of looking for a man, I'm going to work on being the kind of woman that I would want to be in a relationship with a man if that were to ever happen again. And so that's what I did. For 8 years, that's what I did. I was a happy, joyous, and free woman in recovery. I still am today, but I mean, I was then too. I went to therapy. I worked with my sponsor. I worked on the issues I had that made me so fearful about trusting God in that area. And I worked hard. And I was happy. I was a happy woman. 2 years ago, March the 8th, 2014, I was asked to go to Flint River. Some of you may know Bo and Shirley T. And I was asked to go host Bo, and my daughter was asked to host Shirley. And so I was going to go. So I got up that morning, and I had packed, and I was getting ready to leave the house. And for some reason, I just started walking through the rooms of my house. And I started crying. I was just crying and walking through the rooms of my house. I thought, what's going on here, you know? And I started talking to God. And I said, God, you know, I have done everything that you've wanted me to do. Everything. And I just want you to know that I'm ready. I just want you to know that. Got in the car, went to Flint River. I cried most of the way over there. I was just so emotional. And I got there, and I was rooming with some friends. One of them's named Jean. So I got there, and Jean was in the room. So I walked in. I said, Jean. And she said, oh, what's happened? She said, you've been crying. I said, let me tell you. So I told her what happened. And I said, I was just walking around the house. I said, this is what I said to God. I told him I was ready. And then I said, let's see how long it takes God And the minute I said it, it was like, oh, no, I have challenged God, you know. Oh, that is not in the books of recovery. You know? Chip and I have a picture that was made less than 24 hours later of us standing on the stage together. He was reading for Shirley's meeting. We've been friends for 14 years. We've known each other 14 years. But in less than 24 hours, everything changed. Everything changed. And a friendship that had been there 14 years changed. 6 months later, we were married. We've been married almost 2 years, and life is wonderful. And I'm able to be the woman that I always wanted to be in a relationship. Only because of Al-Anon and AA. When we got married, I had 24 years in Al-Anon, and Chip had 26 years in AA. My sponsor said, there's not many people that get married with 50 years. And I think that's true. But we have a wonderful life, a wonderful life. You know, I share this story for two reasons. One is, I have to tell you this. This girl came up to me after a meeting one time, and she said, you said you worked on that 8 years. She said, am I going to have to wait that long? And I said, I hope not. I said, maybe you only have to wait a couple of months. But I said, I had a lot of stuff to work on. I said, I had a lot of baggage I was pulling behind me. But I tell that because this is so important to me. I thought for that whole 8 years that I was waiting on God to do something. But see, he was waiting on me to do something and tell him I was ready. My God expects me to do the work. He expects me to do my part. And you know, when I do my part, he's going to do his part. But I got to do my part. And I got to tell him when I'm ready. The other thing I learned was, don't settle. Don't settle. I settled so many times. I just wasn't willing to wait for that miracle. I wasn't willing to wait for God. I didn't trust God. I didn't believe God. Don't settle. We know when we're in a relationship if it's of God. We know if it's of the God of our understanding. We know if it's of our recovery program. We know if it's of the things we've learned in these rooms. We know. Don't settle. You know? This has been a wonderful, miraculous, phantasmical way of life for me. Just beyond imaginings. I would guess that probably the relationship that I have with the God of my understanding has probably been the most powerful thing about recovery. But isn't that what's supposed to be the most powerful thing about recovery? You know, it's no joke, when I first said that third step prayer, I was really fortunate. My Al-Anon lineage started with Arbutus, who started Al-Anon in Texas. And back in those days, the only literature they had was the Big Book and the 12 and 12. So that's what Arbutus used. And as my lineage has progressed, my folks and my ancestry have continued to use those two books, along with all of the wonderful Al-Anon literature that we have as it's been published. So when I was raised in the program of recovery, I was raised with some wonderful Al-Anon literature, but I was also raised with the Big Book. So when I did my steps and I finished step three, my sponsor said, you go home and read the third step prayer, and from this day forward, you will say it every day the rest of your life. And when I finished step seven, she told me the same thing. Well, you know, I didn't know about the God thing. I didn't know about that. And I did step three with Debbie, but see, I did it where it says, you know, made a decision. What I said was made a decision one day. But see, I didn't tell Debbie I was saying made a decision one day. See, I said, I don't have to do it now. I've just got to decide to do it, but I don't have to do it now, you know. But when she told me I had to go home and start saying that third step prayer every day, I couldn't say one day. When I said, God, I offer myself to thee, it didn't say one day. It said right now. And that next morning when I sat in the shower, I truly did believe that God was going to kill me. See, I had kind of tried to stay under God's radar. I don't know if any of you know what that means, but I just kind of trying to stay under there, not cause any attention to me, just kind of be under there, you know. And when I said, God, I offer myself to thee, I thought, oh, I'm up there. I'm up there. I'm going to get his attention, and he's just going to kill me. He's so disappointed in me. I'm so worthless to him. He's just going to do me in. And I will tell you, a long time I believed that God was going to kill me when I would say that prayer. But see, I was in so much pain, I was going to do what Debbie, my sponsor, told me to do. Finally, one day, I didn't think he was going to kill me. Finally, one day, I started singing that. I sing it most days now. But that's what turning my life over meant to me. It meant when God sees me, he's just going to kill me. But he didn't. He loved me enough, as Debbie loved me enough, my first sponsor, to walk me through and to continue to walk with me today. You know, while we've been meeting here this weekend, there are people that are meeting all over the world. They're meeting in all kind of places. Some of those places I know about are, there's some women that meet in a field in Africa because it's a safe place for them to meet. There's some people that meet in a large church in London, England. There's some people that meet in a little red brick house in Level Plains, Alabama. There's some people meeting on the beach. And we're meeting here. What we all have in common with each other is we all speak the language of the heart. I can't thank you enough for letting me share my language of the heart with you today. My name is Angie Baldwin, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. Thank you.